have lived in for 10 years and am appalled by the growth of ugly apartment complexes, tract housing, fast food chains, and traffic in the last 2 years. I can't imagine anyone wanting to move here now. It's turned into every other vanilla town in America.
10 years ago, this used to be the coolest place. 10 years ago, there used to be so much more space. 10 years ago, community thriving. 10 years ago, local bands driving.
That was 10 Years Ago by Broderick Cole, and that is now out on Paramount Weston Records. You're listening to the DTFH, and underground legend Sage Francis is here with us today. We're going to jump right into that, but first this. I want to thank Squarespace for supporting this episode of the DTFH. Squarespace, they've got everything you need to create an immaculately beautiful website, which will act as a kind of beacon to hyperdimensional angels that will come and visit you to thank you for creating a beautiful website like the one you'll find at DuncanTrussell.com. I use Squarespace every week. Squarespace has got everything you need. If you want to create members-only areas where you can put a little paywall around your content, you can now do that through Squarespace. They've got shopping cart functionality. You can, whatever it is you want to sell, you can easily do it with Squarespace. And that's what I like about the service more than anything. It's simple to use. It's not like the old days. If you're my age and you had any experience trying to assemble a website 10 or 15 years ago, you know how horrible the experience was. It would be easier to put electric eels into your ass and let them hang off your nipples than build a website back then, when you had to worry about certain lines of code that would tell it to go to the right size depending on what phone was looking at it. All of this is now taken care of by the necromancers, wizards, sorcerers, and arcane artists over at squarespace.com. Try them out. You can head over to squarespace.com/Duncan. You can try it out for free, and then when you're ready to launch, use offer code Duncan and you'll get 10% off your first order of your website or a domain. Again, it's squarespace.com/Duncan. Use offer code Duncan and you'll get 10% off your first order of a website or a domain. Thank you, Squarespace. And we are back. Here's some disturbing news from the BBC. Squirrel injures 18 people in 2 days of attacks on Buckley. If you go to bbc.com, you can find this. It's NSFLW, not safe for life or work. Warning here. I'm looking at somebody who's got a pretty nasty squirrel bite on their finger. But it just looks like this squirrel went nuts and just started attacking people. My attorneys have told me to make sure to reiterate that I don't have any kind of device that could cause squirrels or small animals to attack people who were not subscribed to my Patreon. And they want me to really emphasize that I am in no way making any kind of veiled threat to you, that you're going to get attacked soon by a small to medium-sized animal if you don't subscribe to my Patreon, which is easy to subscribe to, so there's really no excuse to not do it. It's patreon.com/DTFH. It's really the very least you could do if you want to avoid getting attacked by these things. And by the way, just because it's small doesn't mean it can't cause some pretty deep cuts. And I mean, generally, and again, like I'm saying, I have nothing to do with it. And it would be insane for me to say that right now the animals that we're using the hypno beam on have also been tested to make sure they're not rabid, but pretty soon we're going to run out of funds to keep that kind of testing, meaning that we can't guarantee that the animals that attack you if you don't subscribe to the Patreon are disease free. That would be nuts for me to say. That would be literally insane for me to say to you directly and bluntly, I have the device. It was sent to me by somebody who has access to all kinds of bizarre technology. They thought it was just a funny thing and are very surprised and a little dismayed that I'm actually using it to cause animals to attack people who don't subscribe to my Patreon. That'd be, only an idiot would say something like that. Obviously, devices like that don't exist. Again, it's patreon.com/DTFH. Subscribe, you'll get access to commercial-free episodes of this podcast. You can join us. It's January 2022. We are now doing a 30-day meditation challenge. And that just means that we're checking in on the Discord that you'll have access to every day when we do our sitting meditation. But you can join our meditation group, Journey into Boredom, which meets every Monday online. And of course, our famous Friday family gatherings. They're there for you every Friday. And even better, and again, I don't mean this, and I'm not saying this is true because obviously it's not, but even better, you'll be protected from, well, you know what I'm saying. So again, it's patreon.com/DTFH. Please subscribe. I've got some shows coming up. Number one, I'm sad for my Austin friends. I had to cancel again because of the Omicron, whatever the fuck it is. I'm not going back to Austin to get COVID again. And I'm really sorry that I had to cancel those shows. But I will be in Nashville the Valentine's Day weekend. And I hope that you will come and see me and Johnny Pemberton there. And lots more dates are coming up. You can find them at duncantrussell.com. With us here today is a rapper and the founder and CEO of Strange Famous Records. This is a great conversation. We talked about what it's like to be an independent artist and the strange, circuitous route his career has taken over the years, the way he took off in the early days of the internet when people were still using Napster, and what it was like to experience that kind of sudden weird fame. This is he's a brilliant person. I've been thinking about this conversation ever since we had it. So now everybody, welcome to the DTFH, Sage Francis. Sage, welcome to the DTFH. This is my favorite kind of episode, by the way, where I get to meet someone from people online connecting us, which is what happened, as I recall. So to me, that's the most mystical and mysterious way to connect with somebody. It's great to meet you.
That's the only way I know how to meet people these days. So that's wonderful. Thank you for having me on the show. I don't remember how that happened. I remember I reached out to you on Twitter just to thank you for having the voice that you have, and stuff like that's keeping me sane. Thank you. It's good.
So the pandemic, how are you weathering the pandemic? How many kids do you have?
Got a 7-year-old girl, a 5-year-old girl, and a 1-year-old boy.
Oh, wow. And, yeah. So how is that? Yeah, how has the pandemic been?
It started off shaky, having to do the distance learning. My wife took over most of those duties, but it was driving her a little crazy. And then with the pregnancy and everything through the pandemic, that was... Everything has been trying. It's been one fire after another. It's like we take it one fire at a time. And right. That's why I'm at this point now where, you know, I've always been a homebody, even though I toured the world for, you know, a couple decades. I'm very, yeah. very happy and comfortable just being home. And but I've never been in a home with so many moving parts in it. And that's become the challenge for me to try to find my and my peace. And it's going good though. Like everyone's healthy and happy, and I'm no complaints really.
Yeah, well, right. It's, I think at this point, lots of us are feeling that way, you know, where it's my wife and I, you know, this morning after the millionth COVID scare and the millionth COVID test, and you know, a friend's kid has it. And so then, okay, shit. The kids have the sniffles. Oh shit. Is this COVID and all the weird stuff? You know, we just felt it again. And it's been a little bit since I felt it. And by it, I mean that burn. Like it's like you're in stuck in your fingers are stuck in a door or something that you like this sense of like, when the fuck is this going to end times a million? Like,
I know it's the impending doom. It's the impending doom that we're all going to like have PTSD from for years to come. I don't know what it's going to be like for the generation who's coming up in this, the people who have to actually go to school and operate within this just like new weird rules and restrictions. But it could be way worse. That's all I keep thinking is like, it could be worse. Yeah. It sucks. The vaccines aren't as good as they should be or could be, but you know, like we're taking it as we go. It's fine. We did, one of our girls did test positive, which got crazy for us in the house, but you know, no one else got it. My wife and I are vaccinated. Apparently the baby boy gets antibodies from the breast milk.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're good. I'm not really tripping about that. The worst part about it was like, the fact that we never get to go out to eat anymore, and I can't do shows. I don't feel comfortable. I still don't feel comfortable doing shows.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So, yeah, I bet, man. I'm the last time I did shows, and I am starting to do them again because I am vaxxed. And, well, I guess I've been triple vaxxed now because I actually got – what's that?
You got the booster shot.
No, I got the booster from nature. I got COVID, and the reason I got COVID is because I went to do shows in Austin. So okay. I got a breakthrough case, but just like you're saying, I didn't pass it on to my family. And I'm assuming that had something to do with the vaccine, you know, cause I was like sneezing on them and stuff. I thought it was allergies. But yeah, that's exactly what it feels like. Well, at least the kind I had, which was, I can't remember the name of it. Delta or whatever, that's like, it feels just like springtime allergies and until it gets like sort of bad. But yeah, I know what you mean. We're trying to do it one day at a time. Is it like, it's not just like it's affecting your shows. You represent like a family of artists.
Right.
And so that must be really interesting trying to have a label during this insane plague. What is that like?
Well, being the flagship artist of the label I own, and the fact that the way we can make the most money is on tour. And when I bring artists on tour with me, and then for the first time in my adult life, I'm not doing shows anymore. And I'm seeing the result of that, which is, damn, my business has taken a massive hit.
Yeah.
I was, you know, there was some arrogant part of me that was thinking, oh, it doesn't matter. You know, people are going to support no matter what, you know, you really earned this very loyal fan base. And we do have a loyal fan base, but the fact that we don't get to go to their town and they can't like support us at the merch table, it's the difference between what I make now and then is massive. So I have to think of different ways for us to succeed and do well, and for our artists to, you know, gain a bigger audience, not just because I put them in front of live crowds, but, you know, how are we going to navigate the great restrictions of the internet now that like major corporations have figured out how to gatekeep, whereas before in the Wild West of the internet, it was like the public at large finally was able to decide who was going to be successful or not.
Right.
Which I greatly benefited from, because I didn't have, there was no money behind me. There was no corporation behind me. It really was just like a word of mouth, people spreading files on Napster and LimeWire and Kazaa. Yeah. And, you know, I saw the benefits of that. Like, I was very lucky for that to happen at a time when it did. And then for me to see how it got less and less, like people became less and less accessible to us through algorithms, random throttling, and, you know, it's just crazy internet games that, boo, you know, like, fuck, it's what it is. You know, we should have expected it. We kind of did, but no matter how much complaining, no matter how much bitching about Spotify and this and that, it doesn't change anything. People, you know, people are given their circumstance. They work within that circumstance, and we have to figure out how best to make it work for us.
Right. You know, what's so crazy about you and your fame and success is that it is how people who don't understand anything about like the music business think that's just how it happens, that it's some kind of democracy. A musician, I mean, one of my favorite Mr. Show sketches is like David Cross is like singing in a stall of a bathroom some like stupid song, and Bob Odenkirk is in the other stall and he's like, "You're gonna be a star," and then, like, you know, he just takes off just from that. And you watch, what was that? My wife gets mad at me for making fun of this movie. It's like Lady Gaga is some kind of singer. Do you know what I'm talking about? It's
yes.
She
had a hit song. It actually was on the radio.
She gets discovered in a bar or something, and then she sings some song in the parking lot of a grocery store with the singer who's already famous. But then within like 2 weeks, she's in an arena in front of everybody. Wow, just massive success. But, you know, now that I've been friends with musicians for a while, I've seen the reality of what has to happen and the number of people who have to. It's almost like a political campaign takes place to try to elevate musicians. Absolutely. And it's the opposite of that romantic, like democratic idea of the people, a populist artist, but that's what you are. Can you talk about the like what it was like? Cause I mean, we're talking about technology that is now essentially obsolete, but that very technology, like that's what brought you in to like a kind of dream situation for an artist to be in, like a lot of freedom.
Yeah. Well, I had those, I did, like many people or most people, I had romantic notions of what it was to become signed and discovered and be put on a platform just because you're talented. And a lot of people I've met through my life are super talented who will never get access to as many people as they deserve. But there was that special moment in time where I had given up on believing I was ever going to be discovered. I had adopted a DIY ethic where I said, okay, even if it's not pristine and it's not as glossy as the hip hop I grew up on and loved, if I can make it the way I'm able to make it, and I know there's people who are going to appreciate it, I can make it available to them. And then when I did that, and when the internet gave me the ability to do that, then I was able to do shows all over the world. I suddenly had audiences in Sweden and England, you know, and I was traveling, like, I'm just flying out. I have no idea what's going on. And but they all know my music, even though there was no publicity behind it. There was no, you know, I never paid anyone to do that in the early years. And I couldn't make enough mixtapes because they were all, you know, they just were selling and selling, and I was like making them all by hand, and then the mix CDs, eventually the albums. But it was a grind, you know, like I never would have expected. For the fantasy I had as a 12-year-old when I won my first like rap contest, and I won a t-shirt from the DJ who signed it, and I just went to bed with it, hugging it. And I was like, this is it, man. It's really going to happen. You know, like 10 years later, I'm just grinding it out so hard, doing everything I never thought I would have to do, because I didn't understand what you needed to do in the music business in order, you know, to excel and get an audience. And it turns out you're not being able to, you're not creating most of the time. You're working most of the time. So it's a job job. You know, it's a, you're working a job when your whole fantasy was about escaping work and escaping jobs. Just like, I'm talented, so it's going to work out. Nope. And I knew that too. I was lucky enough to just live long enough to know what working a shitty job was like. And then saying, I'd rather work twice as hard for myself, even if I make a little less money, with the option perhaps to level up at some point. And that did happen. I never took any opportunity for granted. It was like, if someone offered me to play in some cafe or in a laundromat in Idaho, I was there, you know, like, until it got to a point where there were diminishing returns, you know? So, but I did take on every single opportunity. And I worked my merch booth. Like, you know, I see these artists, they get off stage and they go immediately backstage to chill. You're like, this is the life. Yeah. I'm like, you're missing out. Even if it's $50 or $100, like, get that money, because it's not guaranteed for ever. Like, you're never going to be guaranteed this opportunity again. So that's what it was like. It's been a lot of work. It was sleepless nights. It was making, you know, friends as when I could, and networking when I could, and making enemies along the way, and trying to avoid any nonsense that would deprive me of moving forward.
It's 2022, and you're still sleeping on something that feels like you found some old dead coyote carcasses out in the desert and wrapped them up in a blanket. Your back's hurting. You're having nightmares of wild things chewing on your legs at night, and you're trying to figure out why. The answer, it's your hell mattress that you're sleeping on. And I know there's a lot of gimmicks out there right now promising you a good night's sleep with some kind of bullshit weighted blanket filled with isotopes that were gathered in some field in Sumeria. Fuck that. That's just putting lipstick on a pig. If you're sleeping on a terrible mattress, your sleep is going to be terrible. If you're laying on some lumpy, cursed thing that feels like an old, withered giant cicada from the Jurassic period, how are you going to fix that with some blankets? It's not going to work. I recommend sleeping on a purple mattress. Only purple mattresses have the Gel Flex Grid. It's a super stretchy, ultra squishy material that adapts and flexes around pressure points and doesn't retain heat. The Gel Flex Grid is amazingly supportive for your back and legs while cushioning your shoulders, neck, and hips no matter how you sleep. I've got a purple pillow and I love it. It feels like I'm laying my head on a pillow from the future. You deserve it. It's 2022. There's a lot of things we don't have control over, but you do have control over whether or not it feels like you're laying on top of bundles of dry carcinogenic herbs that somebody wrapped in mummy wrappings and forced you to sleep on in some dungeon in the distant past. Purple, you deserve it. Try your purple mattress risk-free with free shipping and returns. Financing is available too. Getting a good night's sleep starts with having a great mattress. Get a Purple mattress. Go to purple.com/Duncan10 and use code Duncan10. For a limited time, you can get 10% off any order of $200 or more. That's purple.com/Duncan10, code Duncan10 for 10% off any order of $200 or more. purple.com/Duncan10, promo code Duncan10, terms apply. I love your story because, you know, the pillars of the thing are something that I've discovered that is very comforting to me, which is hard fucking work. That's the thing, man. Like, there seems to be a universal form in people who have had any kind of real success is like, that is what you have to work really hard. There isn't any way out of that. And I think working for yourself is the, it's an incredible feeling, but still, you know, just to, you know, today I work for myself. I love my job, but my back is fucked up. My back's fucked up because I've been picking up my kid and sitting at this freaking desk every day. You know what I mean? Editing podcasts. Yeah. And it finally is like, fuck you. But somebody, I was like chatting with someone on the Patreon and they're like, you got to get a standing desk. And I'm like, I don't want to admit I have a desk job. You know what I mean? But right. I do. I'm at a desk. But the other interesting thing about the kind of fame and success that you have is your fans are like, they're like, you're everything to them because they found you, you know, they found you through God knows through the weirdest possible way.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
They found you the old school way of people finding musicians that they love. And so I think that initial discovery is the algorithm doesn't understand that at all. That's something that just is overlooked or people don't even understand that
anymore. I'm so grateful
but
for that. I'm very lucky for that. I wish I could bestow that same opportunity on other artists that I think deserve it. I do my best as a label owner. I'm very careful with who I work with. My fans trust those kind of decisions because it is a special relationship where I was never forced on anybody. You know, no one got tricked into listening to my music or being, you know, I'm not playing inside of supermarkets. I'm not like, you're not being inundated with Sage Francis material. So if you find it and you get into it, you really lock in and, you know, if you identify with it, you see that there's something unique to what I do that you aren't getting from other sources. And that is what I think great art is all about. We're all living a very similar situation. We're all living a similar experience in life. But the differences that certain artists are able to pick out and accentuate and make others feel like they're not so alone in their situation because no one else communicated it before. Yeah, but also, you know, you attract the weirdos as well, where they think everything is about them. You know, you have to be very careful about the access you give people to your personal life. And I've been very careful about my privacy, less and less so in my older years. But, you know, through much of my adulthood, I threw a lot of trapdoors and labyrinths into what I say and what I say about myself and who can actually like pinpoint what's what. Mm. It's not about the absolute truth of a personal situation, but what you understand about a situation. Like if you didn't live it, it's not going to come out your horn. So I don't have to worry about feeling inauthentic, but I do have to worry about people knowing too much about me personally.
Yeah, I think it's super important. And yeah, totally. And that seems to be one of the big misconceptions people have about musicians is this idea that every single song is like a journal or right. a direct rendition of something that happened in their life. I think that's a sign of a really good artist is that just like what you're saying, their real life experience is coming through a kind of artistic distortion.
Right.
You know, it's like, it's not a lie necessarily. It's more like a gel that you put over a light or something. The light's still there. Yeah. It's just colored with a symbol set that maybe necessarily didn't happen.
Well, I'm...
Listen, to me, though, like...
Okay. No, you go.
No, please.
Well, my first studio album was called Personal Journals. And so I put a lot of my life into that. But I was only 23 years old.
Yeah.
And people still will listen to that album as if I'm that same person. And if I don't reflect all the truths and the identity points of that album, I'm a fraud, you know, like, yeah. So to live with, you know, people always talk about imposter syndrome, but I don't really suffer from that. 'Cause I'm just like, you have to be reasonable as a listener or like someone who is experiencing art to say, what's the context of this? When was it done? And, you know, like, why does it matter to me? Is it because he's that person or because I'm this person? There's going to be something that never changes when you think of it as because I'm this person. That is the constant for the listener. For me, it's weird. Like, I can look back on stuff that I've done, I still be very proud of it, but not even identify with it.
Right.
And that has to be awkward and weird for other people to consider, especially in hip hop, where at first we were like, this is the realest fucking music in the world. They say their exact situation. And then you go find out like a lot of them were ghostwriters and, you know, people were doing their it was so much fakery involved in this big glossy presentation to the world that we thought was just raw, authentic street art. And it was based in that. A lot of it still is. But honestly, I think we've gotten to a point where we realize, okay, there's a lot of entertainment trickery going on in this. And we enjoy it for what it is because that's just what we like. Not because I actually believe that Ice-T is going to kill a cop.
Right. I mean, it's show business. And this is... This is just the reality, and I think sometimes people struggling with imposter syndrome are people who are really struggling with that reality, or it's a little naive. They had a dream about, you know, this is the, you know, a direct perfect replication of my soul being broadcast out into the world, and then they met the reality of like, yeah, but like, you're not always soul projecting, you know, like some days you just feel like shit. You don't want to do music or art or anything at all, you know? And yet I think that insane, naive belief that you got to wait until you feel the spirit of the Lord move inside of you or whatever to like produce things. It's sad.
But as artists and anyone who does any type of craft, or maybe any type of skill job, whatever it is, you're always going to know someone who's better than you. There's always a bigger and badder wolf.
Yeah.
And in a lot of instances, you might be getting better compensation for what you do while you know there are better people, like people who do it better
than
you. Fuck
yes.
And that, I think, is the imposter syndrome of it. I think comedians get away with a lot of, like, they get to tell tales and like tell their story, tell very personal stuff and get away with it because they get to blow it off as a joke. Or like, if any fire comes to their feet, they're just like, hey, man, it's just a joke. I'm just a comedian.
I'm a fool.
Whereas musicians, yeah, I'm just a big dummy. I'm just a big dummy with these wonderful connections of words and ideas that somehow I made this puzzle make sense and you connected to it, but I'm just a dumb dummy.
Yeah.
So, but
exactly.
I don't know. I try to get away with it myself. And I think musicians want to do that as well. But a lot of us are stuck really living, you know, like, I don't know, having to account for every single thing that we do. I write in character a lot of the time. Similar, like, I like to say, like, when people come at me about certain stuff, I've never tried to, like, no one ever tried to cancel me, but obviously there's people who's like, you know, what you said here is exclusionist or, you know,
right,
ableist or misogynist. And I'm like, yeah, it is misogynist. Like, that's that character. Like, you're supposed to look at it as a misogynist character and look into the mind of what a misogynist is how they think, how they process a situation, how they can blow it off as a complete narcissist. And that's interesting in its own way. It's the way Stephen King would write characters. Like, you don't look at his characters and blame him for being mentally ill. But
rap
is an interesting beast, and I don't know. Maybe it's not like that anymore. I can't speak for hip hop in general.
You don't read Lolita and say, "Oh fuck, this is autobiographical for Nabokov." This, you know what I mean? You don't. But yeah, with musicians, my wife, she loves Taylor Swift, and she'll play Taylor Swift songs to me, and then explain who she's singing about, and then like. They've got pictures. There's some song with a scarf in it, and she'll show me a picture of the guy wearing the scarf. And like, see, there it is. And it's like, you know, this is, yeah. But I think there's something really fun about that and beautiful about that until it's not just about a scarf. It's like what you're saying, where you're just trying to express a character's experience of reality that isn't you. And people are like, what the fuck is wrong with you? And then you have to sit down and explain.
There's a lot of parallels between what I've done and what Taylor Swift does, which is funny to admit. But the basics of it is that, and in the most simplest terms, what everyone experiences in their life is being fucked over by a partner, where you feel the most vulnerable and hurt. And you harp on that as an artist, where you get to tell your side of the story and you never get to hear the other person's side of the story.
Yeah.
And I've benefited from that myself. And I have to be honest with myself about it, where my wife told me one of her favorite songs of mine was a song called The Rewrite, where I kind of lash out at my first girlfriend of 4 years who left me. And I just was like, bitch, 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 bitch. But, you know, I try to like salvage it by the end and say, nah, you're a woman, you know, but it's the whole time. It's my take on a story where I never explain how I was unfair to her. I never explain, but it doesn't matter because I know what people think when they break up. So that's the inspiration behind the song. That's how I know people are going to relate to it. And that's what Taylor Swift does with her music, and just throwing a few sprinkles of truth and clues where people can pinpoint the scarf. You know, she knows that. She knows that's that, you know, including those little details is what's going to get people like pumped up about what she's doing and think to themselves, God damn, this is real. And, you know, more power to her.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that there's a story. I heard this story. Charles Bukowski, he's on an airplane. He's drunk. He's like hitting on the fucking flight attendant. Whoever he's with, like stops him. He's like, you're drunk. Stop. You're like basically assaulting this woman. Stop. So later, this guy calls Bukowski. He's like, hey, I read the story you wrote about us on the plane where you say that you stopped me from hitting on the flight attendant. That was me stopping you. And Bukowski's like, when you write your stories, you can make yourself the hero.
Exactly.
You know,
Bukowski is an interesting cat. He's one of those artists that he writes so real, but it can't all be real. You know, like everything he writes, I'm like, I can see it, smell it, and feel it. But he's so full of shit at the same time. Every woman, right up until the end, every woman is, you know, like,
oh,
he's a piece of shit. And he's okay with that.
Yeah.
But also there's footage of him. There's an interview where he's kicking a woman on a couch with him. Like, there's a TV interview and he's like, he's totally drunk. He's assaulting this woman. It's like, these are different times. And it's tough for me. Like I have every single Bukowski book. I devoured them. I love the style of writing, and it's the kind of artist where I can't put on a pedestal, or, you know, I'm very careful about how I push his material. 'Cause like, I don't know how to really feel about it now, knowing what I know about him and how he was in real life. But I feel like he kind of redeemed himself by the end. But also he got famous way after, you know, after so many years of just trudging through the mud, and then at what age was he, did he become super popular? And then all of a sudden he had access to women and, you know, drugs and whatever. So,
yeah,
I don't know.
He was a gutter drunk.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a fucking like gutter drunk. That's what Bukowski, and somehow he could write. And, you know, I actually, there's a parallel, I think, between him and Elliot Smith. Which is like, here you have this, his, you have this person who's writing these beautiful songs about their own personal self-destruction, you know? And so you read Bukowski, same thing, beautiful stories, books about their disintegration as a human. And there's something to me, that's really alluring in that. And especially if I want to like subscribe to the idea that I can be completely fucked up on some drug and make incredible art. So this is the lure that like any alcoholic or drug addict loves that shit. Cause they're like, even though they might not be making anything, they're thinking, you know, once I drink enough, I'll probably be writing like this. Or once I'm high enough, this will emerge from me, you know? So, and I love about those kinds of artists is like, they're like, fuck your rules. Fuck your idea of like, here's how you write. Here's how you're supposed to write songs. Here's how you're supposed to do it. You do that yeah. Because this is what I'm doing right now. And I'm going to decide every little piece of it. You know, I'm not saying fuck your ethical rules, by the way. It's always disappointing when you hear an artist you love, it backstage is a complete piece of shit. I mean, what can you do? This Elliot Smith documentary, you know, it's like people loved him so much. But they were still like, he was mean. He was fucking like a dick towards the end.
I never saw that. I'll check into it.
Just
but
wow.
Yeah, he. There's artists that almost every artist I loved growing up has disappointed me in some way. Where it's tough for me to wave their flag anymore. The remaining character or the remaining hero of my childhood was Chuck D, who like, has yet to disappoint me as a human. You know, as a person with ethics and values and. Every other, there's a few that have stuck around, but after all the people I've met and, or I've learned about through my years and through people who know them, it's like, man, you know, like another one bites the dust, fucking one by one, they fell into the darkness. And I've always felt it was necessary. And one of the people are always like, can you give some advice for, you know, upcoming artists? Like my best advice ever is, be very careful who you let in your circle. Be very careful who you allow to be part of your company. Your company is almost everything. The company you keep says so much about you. And, it, you know, if you're benefiting somehow from being around a piece of shit, it's not worth it. Don't take that. And, you know, I could have done better financially probably throughout my career if I had attached myself to certain people. If I had followed certain paths that weren't, you know, ethical, but none of that matters in the end. You know, like this life is so fucking short, and you have, if you're a creative person, there's so much power in those moments. If you allow anything to taint it, you just, the disservice you do to yourself is going to scream at you. Down the line, like absolutely scream at you. And it's, you know, down the line isn't as far down as you really think it is. It's coming. So, you know, atone for your bullshit.
Atone. I want to thank Bespoke Post for supporting this episode of the DTFH. It's winter. It's time for you to upgrade your daily routine with Bespoke Post and their new seasonal lineup of must-have Box of Awesome collections. Bespoke Post partners with small businesses and emerging brands to bring you the most unique goods every month. My 3-year-old Forrest is in a pancake phase right now, which is why I really love their Over Easy box. This has got everything you need to make incredible pancakes: a cast iron skillet, Vermont maple syrup, Hayden flour mills, pancake mix, and also Bloody Mary mix, so that you could have a really nice brunch at home. And what's cool about the cast iron skillet in this setup is you could take it outside and Make your pancakes over the fire. Make your Bloody Mary over the fire. Just like hunters and explorers of ancient times used to do. Plus, with each box of awesome, you're supporting small businesses. 90% of everything that comes in your box of awesome is from a small, up-and-coming brand. To get started, you just take the quiz at boxofawesome.com. Your answers will help them pick the right box of awesome for you. They release new boxes every month across a ton of different categories. It's free to sign up. You can skip a month or cancel anytime. And each box costs only $45, but has over $70 worth of gear inside. You can get 20% off your first monthly box when you sign up at boxofawesome.com and enter the code Duncan at checkout. That's boxofawesome.com, code Duncan, for 20% off your first box. Thank you so much, Bespoke Post. Atone. But how? How do you atone? I mean, what does that look like? And also, you know, this atonement that you're talking about, I think this is, right now we're in the age of justice and this kind of like fascinating, my wife and I were talking about this, how phones have replaced guns. Like in the old West, somebody is like being an asshole and you pull out your gun, like shoot them. But now we pull out our phones and destroy their lives, you know, and it's not a physical kind of execution. It's just more of a like, you know, public humiliation that is often well deserved. But it's like we need to enter the age of atonement, right? Like we need to find a way to where, you know, these people who've disappointed us, including ourselves, where we find a way to alchemize that. You know, convert it into something that shows like the incredible possibility of starting over.
Yeah, it's just scary. No one, you know, fear is what keeps people from doing that. Fear of the unknown. Because if you start over, maybe you lose everything that you gained through whatever bullshit you were involved with, and you don't think you can get it through any other means. I suppose just trusting in yourself and, it may not always work, and maybe that's okay. Maybe you're not supposed to have what you have if it takes you being a piece of shit or working with pieces of shit. So I'm okay with that. I don't think, and people aren't just pulling out phones. They're still pulling out guns. So it's like,
that's true. Sometimes the guns in one hand, the phones in the other.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, that's just the world we live in now. There's just more weapons. So how do we atone? I don't know, man. How do we do it? I feel comfortable in myself. I'm happy with where I'm at, despite the fact that I know I could have done more. More people, I think, should find that type of peace and acceptance, even though maybe I'll go bankrupt in a couple of years. You know, like maybe I shouldn't like speak so confidently, but the things that I've learned over the years while I was making money and then not making money and transitioning from being married to my music to being married,
yeah,
and you know, with kids, and what this home life is all about, which is not something I experienced myself too much as a kid. I grew up an only child in a, you know, a latchkey kids type situation. Spent a lot of almost all the time to myself, not just as a kid, but early adulthood. And now I have to navigate 100 moving parts in a house that just won't allow me to go down certain rabbit holes I used to enjoy in my quiet solitude.
Yeah.
And I've been in a massive transition over the past 3 years, and I have to learn how to feel totally comfortable in it, and I'm getting there, but it's never with regret, and it's never with me thinking I miss the old freedoms. I cherish the time that I had when I had it, when I did those things with the people that I did them with. And now I'm in this whole new world and I'm atoning for every broken relationship, every missed funeral, all that stuff, man. I don't know. I feel like I'm in a weird position where I can't totally pinpoint how several other people should deal with their own situation, because mine is very specific to me.
But, sure. Yeah. Well, I think it's for me. I mean, I love what Ram Dass teaches about it. In the term atonement, it's so heavy. I should have come up with a better term, but he calls it burning off karma. And it's really,
I brought
like,
it up.
Oh, okay. I it's the kind of word I use and think about, but the burning out with the idea is it's like, look, you're here. And because you're here, you're going to make ripples, whether you like it or not. Any action is going to produce some kind of reaction in your environment. And because probably you're an imperfect being, some of those ripples are going to like hurt things, people, creatures, who knows what. This is the reality of being embodied, is like there's no way out of this sort of problematic reality. If you live in, you know, the United States, you're paying taxes. If you're paying taxes, you're buying bombs, and those bombs are definitely being dropped on people. And so in that way,
that was the worst part. For me, that was the worst part of being successful, was that I was paying hundreds of thousands of dollars into the tax system when we had just started wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Yeah. And I knew where that money was going, and it killed me. I hated it. Absolutely tainted that whole experience for me. Like, yay, I get to pay off my student loans and I got to buy the house. But at the same time, there's the other side of it all. What drew you to Ram Dass initially? Because I kind of have only gotten glimpses of Ram Dass and his work and the people who follow him, who just glow about Ram Dass, and you being one of them. But yeah. What initially drew you to that?
Well, my mom was into his, she would listen to these tapes that he made. Can still listen to some of them on Audible, and they're really cool. I'm listening to one right now. It's called Journey of Awakening, and it's like clearly been ripped off of these old tapes. The audio quality is not that great, which I love, because it's got that kind of like,
yeah.
I don't know if you watch Lost, but if you remember, like,
yeah, I was just about to say that. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's got that kind of crackly MK Ultra style sound to it, which I fucking love. And, that weird, like, light distortion. But yeah, so I would listen to those, and I kind of enjoyed that. But then, you know, like anybody, any liberal arts college kid encountered Be Here Now, you know, and started and really liked the fact that here was someone, you know, expressing a lot of these like amazing Eastern ideas, but also mixing in the psychedelic reality and not like poo-pooing, you know, psych- mushrooms or LSD or anything like that. And, you know, it was just a sort of like, he was always there for me, you know, like when I was in I wrote the name of this song. I was listening to your music and now I can't find it. It's like the best song I've ever heard about depression. It's animated. Do you know what I'm talking about, man? It's so fucking good. It's like,
oh yeah. Make 'em purr.
Oh God.
Make 'em purr.
When I was in that phase of my life, I would like lay on a mattress on the fucking floor and like go to Be Here Now or ramdass.org and just listen to his anything I could find. And it was so comforting, probably the way people feel about your music, where you're like, okay, here's someone who gets it and who understands me. And so from there, I just sort of like got involved in his organization and, you know, got to meet the community around him, which are, you know, it's like the good news is there's a lot of Ram Dasses out there. It's just like in the same way that, you know, Ram Dass became sort of a spokesman for a community, you're a spokesperson for a community. You know what I mean? Like you know, because you are connected to this amazing musical reality, which is that right now in like in basements and in little rooms, there are people who are so fucking good that it would melt your brain. Anyone who saw what they could do would be like, wait, what the fuck? What? Wait, who are you? No one will ever find them necessarily, but they're there. Maybe they don't want to be found. A lot of those people don't want to be fucking found. They're not using the same metrics that we yeah. use, you know? So they don't want to be known at all. And if you introduce that possibility, they're like, no, no, thanks. I'm not interested. But so anyway, yeah. And
that's funny because, yeah, that you have to accept the fact that the people that you do know, people that you have access to, are the ones who decided to make themselves accessible. And
yeah,
though there's a takes a special type of person, a special type of psychology for someone to say, I'm going to make this public. I want as many people to absorb it as possible. Whereas there are incredibly super talented people who just are.
Yeah.
And most people will never know about it. That's just how it is. That's just how it's going to be.
Yeah.
I appreciate you telling me the whole Ram Dass thing, because I'm trying to understand what it is that has drawn in so many people that I appreciate, and I get it a little bit better now. So thank you for that.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, it's just like, you know, musically, I know we both enjoy like this sort of authentic music, but we love this kind of authentic writing. And I think that's the other thing that's glorious about Ram Dass, is that within his writings, you will find like a lot of real like honesty regarding his own neurosis and like his own, you know, like when he had his stroke, in the documentary, I think it's called Fierce Grace. One of the things he just says is there wasn't like, oh, here's God, or, oh, when I thought I was dying, nothing happened. All the work and all of it that I thought, you know, okay, meditation is the preparation for death. No. Like, none of it worked.
That's what confuses me about the following of Ram Dass, because he is like that. And it's like, he doesn't have the extra thing where I'm like, cult figures should have, I don't want to call him a cult figure, but like cult figures who have the kind of following that he has, have secret answers.
Yeah.
And he's giving people just bare facts, just like, it's very normal and it's very relatable and understandable, and not tricking anybody into saying, man, I need to achieve this certain thing that, you know, he's unlocked and he has the key to.
Yeah.
From what I've seen. So that's why I'm just so curious and fascinated by all of that. Cause I grew up very, very cautious of religious figures.
Should be.
And cult figures.
Yeah.
They scare me. They creep me out. And anything that like even resembles that, and that, you know, like his movement does.
Sure. But
the more I look into it, I'm like, damn, I kind of wonder, the more psychedelics become normalized, how different his following, or that type of following, will become, if it's centralized, or if it just becomes just everyone accepts certain things as common knowledge and it turns into something else. Because the discussion I saw between him and Terrence McKenna, did you see that, the video of them in the Italian restaurant, I think it was?
I've watched it
like 10 times. It just blows my fucking mind. Those are the kind of conversations you get, you know, from people who are still figuring it out. They don't have all the answers, but, you know, they really want to explore what other people have unlocked, and or trying to make sense of very difficult and complex things. And that's great. I wanted to ask you about that.
That meeting's cool. It represents the pure, you know, Terrence McKenna is like, for the psychedelic community, you could say he's like the Ram Dass of the psychedelic community. He's,
yes,
you know, scientific. He's a purist. And, you know, he's like, even though he talks about, you know, machine elves and UFOs, there's this strangely like empirical, rational quality to him, you know, where in the psychedelic community, you will find these like, you know, you will find a contingent of people who really, who just don't have time for the spirituality bullshit, you know, or who feel like it's kind of a diversion or something. Or, and I think McKenna kind of, it's not like he was anti-spirituality, because I think psychedelics are a spirituality, but just you meet, there's an interesting division that, that happens where, you know, new age spirituality and psychedelics in the new age, like, communities, there's people who think psychedelics are an intermediary phase, you know, something you go through and then you take up spirituality. And in the psychedelic community, there's people who think spirituality is an intermediary phase before you get to psychedelics. And so there can be a little bit of, like, pushback. And I think initially in that conversation, you could sense a little bit of that in the way that they were interacting.
Well, I think the terms are just so ambiguous. It allows people the ability to be amorphous in whatever they can or believe in or say they believe in. And spirituality in particular has always been problematic for me, because I go through phases where I'm like, yeah, I feel spiritual. Like, I feel like there's something beyond what I understand and know about. Yeah, obviously there is. My grandmother, yeah, she's a hard-lined atheist. She's always, you know, card-carrying, like, real hardcore. Whenever you bring up certain things like that, even as a kid, she would confront you and be like, what do you mean spiritual? Like, what do you mean? And if you don't have the vocabulary, if you don't have the references, like, I don't even know now at 45 years old, I'm like, I can only speak in ambiguous, be ambiguous in my terms, because, and that's how sneaky fucking people use language and use movements, because it's, you know, it's easy to navigate through amorphous understandings, ambiguous shit. And so I'm always
unquantifiable bullshit.
Yeah.
Like, you know, this, it just popped up on Twitter. Some woman was selling her farts from, like, 30 day, I don't know, one of these, like, just shows. She was famous, had some kind of reality show fame. She was saying she sold her farts for $10,000 a jar. Something like that. She's literally selling her farts. And I mean,
well, I'm selling NFTs of my farts. If anyone is into the NFT community, I got,
how do you convert your fart into an NFT? Is there special technology for that?
This technology people aren't even aware of yet, but yes, there's lots of fart technology that we've been working on since the 80s. Fart technology was huge when I was a kid. It was like in all the pamphlets my parents would get in the mail. It was like very fart related stuff they didn't know I had access to. And I would, you know, sneak in the mail and find, you know, scientific peer reviewed fart findings that have eventually become digitized and can be NFT'd. So be on the lookout for that.
Isn't it true, though, that the conversion of a human fart into an NFT uses in like a few seconds the same amount of energy the whole planet uses in like 3 years? Like, it takes a lot of juice to turn your fart into
NFT. Not as much as the methane, the farts that are used in, you know, billionaire rockets that go to the edge of our atmosphere and, you know, create a carbon footprint as big as fucking, you know, Pluto. So, yeah, you gotta, like,
if we could fuel this rockets with our farts, that would be so beautiful in some way.
That is the future. That's the future.
Can you imagine explaining that when we finally meet aliens and they're like, so what technology are you using? It's like, it's our farts. We figured it out. That's they're how we,
like,
create
the they're like, finally.
Yeah, this whole time we've been waiting. Why do you think we come to your planet? It's not because we're interested in your dumb asses. We've been harvesting your farts. Now, but
we've been,
you know,
watching you joke about them for centuries. Now you know their use.
The spirituality thing is, like, a lot of people I know who are, like, skeptical, as you should be, about fucking someone selling. See, by the way, some people selling spirituality it's like even more intangible than a jar of farts. It's like we're talking about a thing that is like a purely unquantifiable, unmeasurable thing that most of the time is a thing that you really didn't need anybody to tell you at all. There's nothing that very special about whatever it is, which is why it you suddenly there are secrets, or there's like, you know, all of these like levels to the goddamn thing, because you could sell levels and all this shit. So I think like, yeah, anyone who is like the your number one reaction to anybody like saying something unquantifiable like spirituality, your grandmother's reaction's a good, healthy reaction. And if you ask somebody, what do you mean by that? And they get weird. Well, fuck, get the fuck out of there, because you are in trouble. You know, there should be a never ending open conversation because about these sorts of things. And like that's my opinion on it. You know, that's like, and that's what I loved about Ram Dass in particular is like, there really wasn't as far as I could tell, I never managed to blaspheme in front of those people. And I tried making fun of their guru and like saying things like, weren't you guys just on a bunch of, like, I remember saying to Raghu, who runs the foundation, I was like, don't you think maybe like y'all are out in India and isn't it possible like you are just on a lot of drugs and, you know, and he's like, I don't know, maybe. Yeah, I don't know.
That's the best answer, man. I love that. Yeah, I really, yeah, really love that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
you know, I wasn't very much into church. I didn't grow up in a church per se. You know, I was like Protestant, but not really. Like we went to church very few times that I can remember. But it was always like the you know, like clergy and priests and whatever, like they're held to such a high regard that you can't fool around and joke around and be normal around those, right, type of figures. So it's, you know, for a normal person, at least where I live in puritanical New England, and mostly Catholic New England, it was like untouchable. You know, the rules, just do your thing. Don't create too many waves or ripples in the water. Just go along with what they have laid out for you, because it's been like this for hundreds of years. And I can't shake the feeling that most people understand how bullshit it is, but they can't confront that within themselves or within their family. No. So I feel like I was lucky enough where it wasn't such a hard-lined thing in my family that I couldn't talk about it in my music, that it would stay out of, it's in my writing. It wasn't even a huge part of my life, yet it's all over my writing. Somehow it finds its way into so much of my stuff that, because it made a dent in me as a kid somehow. There was something that I knew was terribly off that was supposed to be very important that I couldn't completely relate with or understand. And it was taboo to question it. So yeah, then eventually that just becomes a thing to rebel against, and not just rebel against, but explore honestly outside of, like I didn't have any restrictions. I could explore it however I wanted.
Do you think that's abuse? Do you think when you make a child question their rational mind, isn't that some form of like generational abuse that's been normalized by organized religion?
Absolutely. But also, isn't parenthood like 80% gaslighting? it's so much of what we do is just to get them through the day.
Right. Yeah. But okay. I love that you said that. And I was, you know, just today, I was on the precipice of lying to Forrest about something, and I didn't. But there are some things you just have to, there's no way to tell the truth about them, you right. know, or like they don't have the words to explain it. So yeah, I guess I've never thought of it in that way, but isn't the difference between the gaslighting of parenthood, which is kind of like, look, I got to get you in bed.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like when I'm saying outside is closed, is the universe outside our house literally closed like a shop? No. But the difference is, if Forrest was like, I don't think outside is really closed, I think it's always there, I'm going to be like, yes, of course, it's always there, but you're going to bed. Yeah. Whereas with religion, if like in some families, if you say, look, I mean, come on, I'm not really sure that this thing that you're talking about exists, you might get put in a fucking closet for a day. You might get, some people get murdered. Some kids get literally killed for it.
Yeah.
So that's the difference. It's like, one is gaslighting because I want you to be a healthy person. The other is gaslighting because I got gaslit and my parents got gaslit and we've been getting gaslit all the way fucking back, you know, and that to me seems like a difference.
Yeah, absolutely. That's, I'm lucky. I feel lucky. We're lucky in America, honestly, we're not a religious run country, even though like the religious right really, you know, has a lot of their paws in the laws, but, I can question it as much as I want. I understand it'll piss some people off. It'll, you know, make me look bad. But when my kids get to an age where they question stuff to me, I wouldn't do what my grandmother did to me. And I'm not going to shame her. I love her so much. Thankfully she's still around. But like, I've told this story before, but she sat me on her knee when I was 8 years old. No, yeah, 8 years old. And she read me a book about Santa Claus. And then she said, now, when we get to the end of the book, she said, you know, Santa Claus isn't real, right? And I was like, I mean, sure, if you're going to allow me to admit that I know that, yeah, that's great. And she was like, it's the same thing with God. And so that was the first night I think I ever prayed. Literally prayed. Like, I didn't know how to pray.
Yeah.
I wasn't given instructions on how to pray. I was like, dear Lord, like, please don't send me to hell. I don't, you know, I'm very scared that, you know, just being in this situation is going to make me privy to torture and whatever else.
Oh my God.
And it took me many years after that to reconcile with those feelings and with the situation I was in. I wouldn't do that to my kids. I wouldn't say it like that. You know, you have to allow people to come to conclusions and not shame them for whichever they come to. But always, you know, I feel like I would be pretty good in helping them navigate ideas that are very confusing without saying there's a definitive firestorm coming their way or, you know, a happy cloud in the end.
Well, by the way, that was very unscientific of your grandmother, because even the most scientific people I know, they're like, we don't know. Don't know. You know, scientific people, that's generally, they'll be like, we don't know. You know, and so, you know, I think that's like, if you want to get real honest, you know, as a secularist, you can't really say there's no God. It's kind of like saying, It's too ambiguous a fucking term, number one. It's like, do you mean
it's arrogant. It's arrogant.
It's arrogant. It's just you.
It's an arrogant term. It's an arrogant way to go about it.
Yeah.
But she's dealing with her own stuff because she grew up in a convent, raised by nuns that mistreated her. And she, you know, like entered Seventh-day Adventist stuff and like everything that like ultimately kind of she felt like screwed with her, and she felt bamboozled by religion and henceforth by God in her, you know, her idea of what God is.
Yeah.
So then forever after that, she was very hardlined. No, like fuck all this, fuck all the people who, you know, try to like make you do what they want in the name of a God. Just, you know, I'm thankful for that part of the lesson. It's just we have to figure out different ways to approach language about spirituality, even though it's like we discussed, it's very ambiguous and tough to lock down and speak about in a way that is, I don't know, concrete.
Well, yeah. And this is the, you know, this is like the big problem, I guess. And it, but, you know, here, like the way people, not to bring it back to like your music or the underground or anything like that, but I feel like with actual like spirituality, you know, actual, and, you know, by spirituality, if I had to, like, just off the cuff invent a definition for it, it would be that the possibility of connecting to something that is maybe outside or that is, like, not so bound to time and space, a kind of possibility, maybe you could say, or a maybe it doesn't even exist yet, a place, you know, a place that isn't defined by phenomena. And in, you know, in Buddhism, the you know what they call it? Emptiness. So literal, like, you know, it's empty. It's this, we're talking about this kind of like space that everything's being held inside of. Like, for all this shit that we're enjoying on this planet, it has to be inside of something. Something is holding all of this, you know? And so, you know, having some kind of like ability to refer to that reality so that you're not always getting grabbed by the swirling hypnotic vortex of this stuff is, I think, quite useful. Mm. And whatever that particular reality may be, I think that the other part of spirituality is you're going to have to figure that out on your own. Like somebody wearing a funny outfit or somebody with like some charisma, you know, they figured it out on their own, like in their own way. And so you, that's the invitation, is like, now you try to talk to that thing. Can you, does it talk back? Is anything answer you? Is that you answering yourself? Anyway, to me, that's the, you know, the way people found your music, or the it's like they kind of had to work for it or get lucky, or it wasn't just handed out to them. And organized religion, it's like what used to happen when there was only radio, right? Yeah. Like, I mean, shit, remember back then you had like, here's like the fucking top 40 songs. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that's what inspired Jesus Christ Superstar. It's like, here, this is what you got. This is what's out there. And people would hear that and they'd be like, that must be the only music. And then if you're a kid in high school, somebody comes and gives you a tape.
Right.
It's the Descendants.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? And you're like, what the fuck is this?
I remember all those
Are
moments.
You yeah. kidding me? Yeah. Wait, what's that? Yeah, yeah. So I think it's similar with religion, which is like, look, if you think the Catholic Church, or if you think that whatever your particular, like whatever your familiarity with Christianity is the sum total of Christianity, that's your fault. You know, that means that you didn't even listen to what Jesus was saying, which was like, this is supposed to be between you and me.
It seems like that's never part of what dudes. Any of those religious sects are about. It's never about what Jesus actually wanted. From everything that I know about the man and the things that came after him, it's not about his lifestyle and his philosophies. They sprinkle that in, but then they just, they really muff it up. And the way we live, the way the laws they enact, it's just in the name of someone they actually don't believe in. It's clearly obvious that those kind of transgressions rule us. They, by law, they have taken over what we are able to do and not do in a lot of ways. It's insane. So I do have disdain for all of it. It really upsets me. It consumes me, and I try to stay away from it. But here we are celebrating, you know, the winter solstice.
How fun. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And look, but here, but you know, it's like, okay, so now we're in this incredible age of technology where technology has become accessible. You can like with a computer and Ableton, with not even that great a fucking computer and Ableton, the shit that you can make right now is insane. Mm-hmm. Right. But so many people, I feel like, are waiting to start making stuff until they get knighted, you know, until someone with a label comes to them and says, okay, now I say unto thee, you are a musician. And then they'll like get, but, or, you know, it happens with comedy where people are waiting for a network to buy their show, or, you know what I mean? It happens with podcasts where people are waiting for maybe a podcast network to hear a pitch, and then they make their fucking podcast, the whole time forgetting that you can right now start making stuff right now. And it's, and it, to me, it makes sense that the identical phenomena happens with religion, where it's like, okay, I need to go through, I need someone to teach me about this, or here's how you do it, or this is what's right and this is what's wrong. Because I'll tell you, man, it gives you an opportunity to procrastinate that conversation that you tried to have with God after you heard that from your grandmother.
Yeah.
And, you know, it gives you an opportunity to, like, put off doing the magical spell, put off trying to, like, call out to the divine, put off, you know what I mean? And put it all off, yeah, because it's not you. You can't do it. Someone else could do it. You know what I mean? And in that way, you end up, like, really cutting yourself off from something, which, by the way, one of the best moments I had with Ram Dass, sitting at the table with the Zen Roshi, and he goes, "It's all in my imagination." And she slaps the table and goes, "Finally, you admit it. After all these years, you admit it. It's just in your imagination." And he's like, "What's wrong with imagination?" You know? And what's wrong with that? Like, what is wrong with, like, connecting to, even if it is, quote, imaginary, a symbol set that is your own mind, maybe, but that still fills you with a sense of spaciousness and, most importantly, a real motivation to not be a dick.
Right. I feel like there is something wrong with it, though. I feel like there is something wrong with it. Because if it's imaginary and it works for you, and you convincingly pass it off on others, it may not work for them, but you were so believable that whatever, like, you were passing on to them, they tried to achieve and they weren't able to, and things just went awry, you know, like with their lives and with what they decided was worth investing the whole of themselves into. Like, that has to happen. That must happen a lot. You know what I'm saying?
But in that, I think in that case, then, you know, yeah, then there's some kind of deception. Like, for example, if you are sort of, if you are misleading people, you know, or you're not sharing, to me, like, if the moment you're sort of openly announcing, which I've seen him do, this is the place, this is what, also various forms of magic too, really do advise, like, use your imagination. Like, this is the whole point, like, visualization exercises and all of these things, like, fundamentally, are any of these things real? Anything real? Like, and generally, like, the answer to that question is, well, they're real in relative reality. In other words, you're real right now. I'm real right now. We're rivers that look like people, or like rivers of atoms that are flowing through time, meeting this, like, an inevitable sort of singularity, which is when we die. It's the end of the fucking river. And so, but right now, you and me, we're real. You're there, I'm here, my fucking back hurts. You know what I mean? Like, I'm experiencing this. So in this level, this is real. But similarly, like, ultimately, you run into this beautiful place, at least in Buddhism, which is kind of not real. And that's where you run into this thing called, like, the Heart Sutra, which is no mind, no body, no self, no life, no death, no beginning, no ending. So it's like essentially a denial of everything, including the Dharma itself. The Dharma is empty as well. A complete refutation of the entirety of the thing. And so when you hit that place, which I think is why you push back against spirituality, when you hit that place, then you get to start over. That's how I see it. When anytime I just fucking give.
Starting over.
Yeah. That's what I love. When I throw it all out.
I will say, like, Buddhism, that part about Buddhism, I really love. Like, I feel like that makes it special to me. Like, out of everything that I've learned from all different types of religions or followings or, you know, spiritual gatherings, whatever, there is an honesty about it that I don't see much anywhere else, where it can probably break the heart of someone who thinks the end result isn't, you just got to start over, dude.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that not special. And again, this is like, there is no, in Buddhism, there isn't much deception about it. And I think Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche calls enlightenment the final disappointment. And it's just sort of like,
right, yeah, that's, yeah, it's, I wanted to bring that up, but that's beautiful. That's yeah. Beautiful.
So that, you know, and I think any fucking religion, organization, or anything that doesn't want you to throw the whole damn thing away when you're ready, when you want to, watch out. Because that's it's like these are, and this is why they're called vehicles. It's like you drive to the beach in your vehicle and then you get out and go to the fucking beach. You don't sit in the car. That's the whole point. These aren't, it's not supposed to be some destination. And anything claiming to be the destination, ooh, that's where I think it gets dangerous. Man, I'm taking up a lot of your time. Do you have a little bit more time? I have one more question I wanted to ask you.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Thank you. I know you have kids and the kids are home. So thank you for this. So
they just came home, actually.
I'm sensing it. So, do you feel like, the metric that I know I use, I've got a family, I got to feed the fucking kids, and I've heard you talk about this metric. Do you feel like the quantification of success through like selling records is like a mistake? As an artist, as a musician, as a performer, I guess to put it plainly, I know someone who is like the most brilliant musician I've ever met in my life. I've never seen anything like it before. It's the most surreal thing to be around the person. I think they're actualized or something. And they don't want anything to do with fame. They're not interested in it. They consider it to be almost a mistake. Like if you end up getting famous or something, you kind of fucked up. What were you thinking? Do you resonate with that idea? Or is that some form of like defense mechanism that people like that use to avoid the like all the scary stuff that goes along with publishing?
Yeah, it's both things. I think for sure there are artists who are afraid to put themselves out on the chopping block where they could, you know, have big record sales and, you know, become famous. And because maybe if they put themselves on the chopping block and it doesn't happen, they will realize I'm not as good as I thought I was. There are also a lot of artists who see the chopping block for what it is. It's a chopping block. And they are more than comfortable being beautiful and creative and having their tiny circle and making it work for their own purposes and not entities outside of themselves that they don't understand. I've spent a lot of my career staying away from bigger entities that, you know, could have propelled me further than where I was. And I've obviously like gotten more, quote unquote fame. Like most people don't know me. If I walk outside the house, no one knows who I am unless I'm, you know, in the supermarket at my, you know, the town of my high school or within 100 feet of whatever venue I'm playing. So, but that's a very comfortable space for me to be in. And I never wanted to elevate beyond that because I really enjoy my privacy. I really enjoy my solitude and I enjoy the relationship I get to have with the fans that I have. But you're absolutely spot on. Like some people are just scared to find out that they're not as good as they are and others know better to even test it. There's no need to test it. They know what they know and that's all that matters.
Thank you so much for your time. It means the world to me. It's such a pleasure to have this great chat with you. Thank you so much. Will you tell people where they can find you?
Well, thank you for your voice. I love your voice and I will listen to it as often as it shows up in my podcast stream.
Thank you.
You can find me strangefamousrecords.com or strangefamous.com. That's my label site. So all my merch and, you know, like we offer personalized letters that I can write to fans and videos outside of the whole cameo thing. But Twitter, Sage Francis, Instagram, Sage Francis, SFR, Facebook, Sage Francis. That's about it. I mean, you can easily find me if you like use a search engine and put in my name. Thank you so much, man. I really appreciate you. Thanks for what you do.
Thank you so much. Hare Krishna. That was Sage Francis, everybody. All the links you need to find him are going to be at DougAtrussell.com. Big thank you to our sponsors. And please subscribe to our Patreon. It's patreon.com/DTFH. And thank you for listening to the DTFH. I'll see you later on this week. Until then, Hare Krishna.